This is Terry Crosby,
Andy Steiger,
Steve Kim.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May the 4th be with you. No?
No.
Come on, you're a spot, please. Aren't you supposed to say adieu or something like that?
No, not
no,
really.
No. Steve, how you doing?
Doing well. Living through some second winter here in Edmonton.
Yeah, I saw the pictures.
Yeah, the other day I get a text from Steve in the morning, his house blanketed in snow. Rumor has it, can you confirm, that you guys got a foot of snow?
In some places, it was pretty bad. And my sister-in-law tells me that in her time in Edmonton, she saw snow just about every month of the year except July. So
wow.
Yeah. I had a relative send a picture, and he did have a foot of snow hanging off his roof.
Yeah, and said it came down fast.
Yeah, down fast.
Wow. Well, speaking of snow, Terry, you just came from back east.
There's no snow in east, in the east part of Canada.
Where were you? What were you up to?
Went to Ottawa, left on Tuesday, came back Friday, attended the National Prayer Breakfast in Ottawa itself.
Awesome.
And so the Prime Minister was there on the distinguished table, along with the opposition leader, Andrew Scheer from the Conservative Party. So yeah, it was very good there. I think the attendance was probably between 800,000 people within in the auditorium.
So those two are going to be going head to head in the election here. Who will take the majority government? We will soon find out. What were some of the main things that were being discussed there in Ottawa?
I mean, this whole gathering was to bring together Christians or people of like-minded faith to pray for what was going on in politics and on the Hill. There was a number of prayers that were given by a number of different people, as well as, you know, Prime Minister got up. There was a Indigenous leader, Kenny Blacksmith, that got up.
Who's awesome, by the way.
Yeah, he's really, really neat.
Did you like him?
Yeah, I talked to him afterwards. And
I gave him a hug once.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. He's like, do you need a hug from an Indigenous person? And I'm yes,
is that
I do.
The one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Interesting story there. Just quickly, my aunt married into the Blacksmith clan. Kenny Blacksmith.
So you're related.
Maybe.
But, by marriage, at least.
By marriage, yeah. So he lives actually in the same area that my mom grew up in, Mistassini, Quebec. So interesting connections there.
The middle of nowhere.
But it was funny. It was a brief conversation with him because he basically said to me, he said, I have to go right now because my wife is waiting for me in the bush. It's goose hunting season. So everything shuts down pretty much in any of the First Nations communities with regards to government and stuff like that. And everybody's in the bush goose hunting.
Love it. Now, Kenny's well known for being one of the leaders, if not the leader, of the reconciliation between First Nations and the government. From my understanding, he's been leading the way in that. Anything else you want to share from Ottawa?
No, it's just a great time together. And I think you could see the unity with the people and their concern, what's going on within our country, and, you know, the need to pray for our country on a regular basis.
If I could actually just give a shout out to our leaders, you know, we've been to the prayer breakfast before. We will continue to. And in fact, we started going to the prayer breakfast because one of the supporters of Apologetics Canada, he constantly encourages us with getting involved in Canada. And he actually challenged us, and I appreciated this. He said, listen, if you're Apologetics Canada, then you should know what's going on in Canada.
Great. Yeah.
And one of the things I find is people on the West Coast have no idea what's going on the East Coast, and people on the East Coast have no idea what's going on the West Coast. So if you're in leadership in either Canada or the United States, at some point, I think it would be something you should really give some consideration to being a part of the prayer breakfast.
In talking with some of the people out there, they were informing me of just a number of prayer groups with on the Hill themselves. So there's actually numbers of people that go into the House of Commons and sit there and pray as the leaders are discussing different aspects of laws and government. So it's very interesting. There's a lot going on up there with regards to prayer itself, which was very encouraging.
Well, it's interesting, by the way, just as a follow-up from the Apologetics Canada Conference, we promoted, you know, to young adults, get involved in politics. And it's interesting. I almost wish I hadn't said it, because we've had a number of our young adults that have been applying for internships and various other opportunities. And I might be losing some young adults because of that. But, looking forward to seeing how young people getting more involved in politics and just really hearing the church supporting that.
I went by the Laurentian Center. Mm-hmm. That's in Ottawa, that actually Trinity Western students go there and live.
Right.
Take in all the aspects of government and get integrated within that for a number of months.
Yeah, it's an amazing, really amazing program.
Really good program. Today we're going to discuss more goings-on with technology, I guess. So you want to lead us in, Andy, on what...
We're going to be discussing something called the Creeper Act, but before we get to the Creeper Act and what it is seeking to address, I think it's first just helpful to begin a conversation about AI. Now, we, a couple episodes ago, talked about AI, and that would maybe be a good episode to listen to as well. What I want to talk about in this episode is there are implications to this idea of imitating humanity that has ethical fallout that need to be discussed, especially in light of where we're at today. We are breaking new ground in technology with regards to such things as machine learning. Machine learning is allowing us to program machines in such a way that they're able to imitate people better than we've ever done.
Can we define machine learning? And how do they do that?
Yeah, with regards to machine learning, there were algorithms that were invented back in the 80s that, and maybe even earlier, the 80s is the farthest back I've seen them. And these algorithms that were designed, it's only been as of lately that we've had the computing power to really run these algorithms, where you've got basically data that's coming in. So you got input. And then you've got what's called these hidden variables that you're developing through these algorithms, higher and higher statistical probabilities through these hidden variables, and then you got your output. And so in doing this, the machine is doing something tacit in with regards that you can't teach it how to play chess, for example, in an explicit step-by-step process, but you can, in a way, using these algorithms, help this machine to be able to understand, but it's not like the machine actually understands. It's using these algorithms in such a way that it can play chess without having to know every explicit way to play any specific move, so that it can learn from the person who's playing. It can even learn from itself. There's a new form of AlphaGo. It's called AlphaGo Zero that's learning from itself, that actually can now beat the AlphaGo program, if you're aware of those.
So they would reference this as narrow AI. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Because it's limited to what we input into the machine itself.
Well, with regards to narrow or weak AI, is the idea that the machine is demonstrating aspects of human intelligence, but it isn't intelligent. Whereas strong AI would be, no, it's demonstrating feats of intelligence and it is intelligent. Mm-hmm. So this is a debate that's amongst computer scientists and philosophers of whether or not you can actually have a machine that's intelligent, or is it just demonstrating aspects of intelligence?
In other words, that whole thing about strong AI is that it's still up for debate, isn't it? Like whether that machine is actually a human being or not, we don't know. And you and I would probably argue that, no, it's not a human being, again, because of your ontology of purpose, namely that what something is determined by the purpose that it was made for. And from that perspective, we would actually reject that strong AI is actually even a possibility there. Is that a fair thing to say?
Right. And that, so that would be one philosophical argument against it. A second philosophical argument that you could use against strong AI is to say that you know the nature of the thing to begin with, right? That it's a machine that's using algorithms to convince you that it's a human. So you would be pretending to accept that it's a human because you know that its nature isn't human from the beginning. One of the ways that this is teased out is it's like basically saying, listen, a bird relies on aeronautics to fly. Thus, if I make an airplane that relies on aeronautics to fly, is it a bird or is it an artificial bird? You know, and people would be like, well, no, it's an airplane. And it's just an airplane that's relying on aeronautics. And so we would say that a machine that's employing machine learning is just a machine that's employing aspects of intelligence, right?
Right.
And there's the whole other question of whether the machine is actually learning in the sense of, I mean, even that word is such a kind of a human thing, right? Or just a, it's a personhood thing. And so whether that machine actually knows what it's doing or knows that it knows what it's doing, that's another question. So I'm thinking of the Chinese room experiment.
And so Cyril has something called the Chinese room experiment.
Right.
You want to tell people what that is quickly?
Yeah. So basically the Chinese room experiment is meant to show that the Turing test, which says that if a machine can mimic personhood so well that the actual person that's engaging with it can't tell whether it's a machine or a human being, then it's passed the Turing test. And the Chinese room experiment was proposed by John Searle, I believe. And he basically said it like this. Okay, let's say there is a room with an English speaker, let's say, who doesn't actually know Chinese. But what he does have in this room is books that actually shows him how to write Chinese and shows, okay, if you get this combination of characters, you put out this combination of these characters. And so, again, the English speaker doesn't really know Chinese, but it has these instructions on how to respond to a certain kind of stimulus, if you will. Well, if this is the input, this is the output that you should have. And so there is a Chinese person outside of the room. He writes something on the piece of paper in Chinese, slips it under the door, and then the English speaker person looks at it, goes through the books, and says, okay, if there is this combination of characters, I write these down, and then he sends a reply back. Now, the Chinese person who receives it on the outside says, oh, this is so good. There must be a Chinese person in this room. So then he opens the door, goes in there, only to see that there is this English speaker who knows nothing about Chinese.
And what he's done is he's imitated that he knows.
Right. So he can imitate speaking Chinese, but he doesn't know Chinese.
Now to take that thought experiment and to bring it over into human and AI interactions, you can then similarly program, for example, a machine, a robot, that is able to imitate what it's like to be a person in different ways. So here's an interesting example. A machine could be programmed to imitate what it's like to be in pain. So now the question is, well, does the machine actually know what it's like to be in pain? Mm. Well, no, it's a machine, right? But it's able to imitate it. So the question becomes, are those the same thing? Is the behavior of being in pain the same thing as actually being in pain? And so we would say, well, no, those are two different things completely. And in fact, this becomes then another philosophical argument against this sort of thinking in saying that, listen, a biological human being is a completely different thing than a robot. And so in the same way that a human being is even a different thing than, say, Wittgenstein would use a lion. And so he would say, listen, you could never speak lion, he would say. And the idea being there is, well, you don't have the embodied experience of what it's like to be a lion. In the same way that this machine doesn't have the embodied experience, it doesn't know what it's like to be a human being. And so all it can do then is just pretend to be human. It can mimic the behavior of being human.
Now, can I throw that proverbial wrench in the gears? I was thinking, because I had that interview with Rob Ray a couple of weeks ago on the theology of video gaming. And one of the points, one of the issues that we explored is the relationship between something and the image of something. So there is that thing and it has its value, but then something else that bears this image, that also seems to have value. So we talked about, for example, Imago Dei, the image of God, how human beings, as Christians believe and Jews believe, we're made in the image of God. And so we have this intrinsic value on the basis of the value that God has, which is infinite, right? there seems to be this relationship. We talked about how we even have products like toilet paper with a certain political figure's face printed on it. And so what would you say to a robot that has this artificial intelligence that mimics human behavior? Is this just still a valueless piece of algorithm and hardware, or is there more to this machine, if you will?
Yeah, that's a great question, Steve, and starts to lead us in the direction that we want to head in now, to head towards this Creeper Act that we want to talk about. So just to kind of bring this conversation up to speed then, so we've been talking about this idea of mimicking human behavior, and one of the areas that we're in the area of robotics, as Steve, you're getting at, is that we are now able to create machines that look very human, and not even necessarily machines. We're just able to create materials that are very skin-like. We're able to paint those skin-like materials very accurately. That in fact, if you were to see some of these, and Wired magazine will often showcase some of these, it's very difficult. You know, you're just seeing a head sitting there on a table. But I mean, it looks like a human being. It's very hard to tell that that's actually not, and that an artist created that. So with that regard, then we're able to make these machines more and more human-like. It's very much like a wax museum. I mean, those wax museums, those are very realistic. But we've even taken it a step further in the realistic aspect. And so what you're getting at then, Steve, is this idea that we're getting to such a degree of accuracy in reflecting a human being that surely this must have some ethical implications. And to that, Steve, I would say you're absolutely right. And Steve and I have been talking back and forth on this a bit while Tyra was in Ottawa, because this is something that I've been really thinking through. You know, to be honest, it's been a while since I've, you know, thought through some philosophical stuff that I, you know, just had to sit on. I was pretty stumped. I wasn't sure where to land on this. So in some ways, I'm still working this out, but here's where I've landed, Steve. I would argue that a machine that looks very human-like is still a machine, and I would say that it has no value. Let me make that argument in this way. So I would say that that machine is dehumanizing, but notice the move I'm going to make here. That machine is dehumanizing, but not because I'm denying humanity to that machine. I would say that the machine is dehumanizing in that the machine is able to reflect real human beings, and because it's able to reflect the image of a real human being, it can be demeaning to the user of the machine and ultimately to society at large. And so that's the philosophical step I would take, because I would be very hesitant to want to say that because a machine is able to image humans and humans have dignity, thus the machine has a level of dignity. I'm going to say, no, that's not the case. Now, where somebody might want to theologically have a conversation here is to say, well, isn't that what we're doing theologically when we say that we're made in the image of God? You know, aren't we God's biological robots, God's biological machines? But here, notice that we've got a difference that's taking place. Humans are made in God's image, but notice they're made in God's image, not in that they're able to imitate God's behavior, but in fact, they have the characteristics of God's nature, such as self-awareness, such as intentionality, such as a moral understanding. So we're not imitating that we have it. We actually do have it. The machine is imitating that it has it.
Mm-hmm. I think I understand what you're saying there. So in other words, you're saying, I think what you're assuming there then is that some of these characteristics like self-awareness, moral understanding, and things like that, these are not the kinds of things that you can code for, if you will, right? This is not just some emergent property that arises out of how molecules collide or things like that. It's either something that you have or you don't, even if it means it may manifest itself over time as you mature as a human being, the natural capacity is already built into you. Whereas with robots and AI and things like that, you kind of have to, well, with robots and AI and whatnot, it's not a natural capacity that it just comes with.
So I would argue two things here. First, before I would even get into that conversation, I'd want to undercut the whole argument right off the get-go by stating that I think fundamentally human dignity is not in our capacities, it's in our relationship. So I would argue that humans have dignity first and foremost foundationally because of God's relationship to me. So notice that the capacities that God gives me through creating me in his image, consciousness, morality, a will, those things allow me to be in relationship with God and allow me to be in relationship with other people. I don't think you need those to be able to enact those capacities to have human dignity. I think simply God as the creator of humanity and God's relationship to humanity is enough. And the reason I'm going to want to argue that are things like the unborn. If a child isn't able to, it has the potential for those characteristics, but it hasn't, say, actualized those. I don't want to say that that child doesn't have dignity. It does. It has dignity in virtue of its relationship to God. And so then the way that I treat that child or the way that I treat a human being actually reflects on my relationship with God.
But that's why I'm saying that it's the natural capacity. That's the inborn capacity. Even if it hasn't been actualized yet, you are the kind of a being that actually has that, right? And so on that basis, then you, I would say that you have value in that way.
Yeah, but I would say that that's like a secondary value that comes from your relationship with other people and back to God. But I don't think it's fundamental. I think the fundamental dignity that humanity has is in virtue of God's relationship to humanity.
So then could we say the same thing about machines? So it is on the basis of our relationship with the machines that we create that these machines now have some kind of intrinsic value? Or is there something different about, obviously there is something different about the different between human beings and God? It would seem to me that it's the same kind of a thing.
Now on that question, Steve, I would want to make another nuanced statement. And that is at that juncture, mm-hmm. I would want to make a distinction between value and dignity. And so with regards to what you're saying, I would argue absolutely a machine has value in virtue of the human's relationship to the machine. But I would argue that that's the case for anything that humans create. Even when I create a painting, that painting has value in virtue of my relationship to the painting. So for example, if I was to create a painting, Terry comes over to my house, grabs it and just throws it in the trash or into the fire, you know, I'm going to be ticked off at Terry, right? Because the painting belonged to me and depending upon why I made it, I mean, it could have a lot of value to me. Now, again, would I say that that painting has value in and of itself? Well, no, I wouldn't. I'd say that it's only going to have value in relationship to other human beings. Now, with regards to dignity, just real quick here, with regards to dignity, I'm going to say that dignity is a step further with regards to value in that I would argue that there's a duty owed with regards to dignity. And I think that's an aspect of dignity that's important to understand is that duty seems to be intertwined with the value.
Right. I've talked on this from time to time on metaethics and things like that and whether objective morality is possible on naturalism or physicalism, right? So in other words, if this world is just, at the end of the day, just a bunch of particles colliding, then can we have such a thing as objective morality? And one of the things that I point out is that in order for you to have objective morality, you need to have objective moral value and objective moral duty. And the case that I make is, okay, because we know intuitively what morality is like. So then let's take away any one of these elements and see what happens. And so one of the things I do is let's say we have a moral system where objective moral duty is missing. All we have is objective moral value. So that is good and evil, right? If all we had was good and evil, but no right and wrong, the distinction between good and evil becomes pretty useless. The difference between good and evil at that point would be nothing more than just the difference between red and blue, difference between one and two, mm-hmm. difference between, and so there's nothing that compels you in either direction. And so in a world where there are no moral duties whatsoever, good and evil become meaningless, really.
So basically, one of the aspects then what we're getting at here, and this gets back to Buber, is my relationships between an I-it and an I-thou then are fundamentally different. With regards to an I-it relationship, I don't owe it anything. But with regards to an I-thou relationship, when I come into a relationship with another human being, I understand that something deeper is happening here, where there is a duty, or in this case, we've been talking about dignity, is owed with regards to that relationship. Now, taking this conversation to its ultimate end, this is something that we as human beings are wrestling with, because we're understanding that when you create a machine convincingly in the image of a human being, depending upon what the purpose of that machine is, has ethical implications to it. So, for example, you can create lifelike machines, and we do, for the purpose of CPR. Now, in that case, you know, I'm putting my lips on another machine's lips, I'm blowing air into its artificial lungs, you know, and I'm doing compressions and whatnot. Now, in that case, that machine is actually dignifying, right? It's a humanizing machine in the sense that it is seeking to uphold the dignity of human beings in that it's teaching you how to save human life. Now, one of the areas that we're dealing with right now in society is that there is what I like to call a dark side to the imitation game. And I don't know if Turing ever thought about the dark side to his imitation game, is that you can imitate both humanizing behaviors and you can imitate dehumanizing behaviors. And important, again, ethical questions need to be raised with regards to that. Steve, with regards to the conversation you had recently on video games, we've thought about this for a while now with regards to virtual persons, so that we can create virtual human beings more and more human-like. You know, what are the ethical implications of that? There's something called Lux Gamer's Dilemma, for example, in which he raises the question, is it wrong to murder virtual people in like a video game? Now, he would say, well, it doesn't seem to be wrong. People don't really seem to have an issue with it. But what about virtual pedophilia? Would we think that was wrong? And so then he plays off of these two, murder and pedophilia, and to say, why is it that the murder one you don't seem to be quite as bothered by, but the pedophilia one you're significantly bothered by? We, through technology, have moved beyond the virtual, which, by the way, for those of you that might be interested, in 2002, the United States Supreme Court passed a law called Child Pornography Prevention Act that they ultimately said making virtual children for sexually explicit pictures was not wrong. So that actually is legal in the United States in two areas. So sexually explicit pictures of actual models who appear to be younger than they are, that's legal. And computer-generated sexual explicit pictures of children, that's legal as well. Now, we can debate that of whether or not that is right or wrong. Now, clearly, I would say that it's wrong. But one of the areas now this is being pressed even more is that we've moved from the virtual to the physical. And so now I can make what I've been calling physical pornography, which raises some interesting ethical implications with regards to how I'm interacting with that machine, the relationship now that I have with, say, people creating dolls of children or machines of children that are used for sexual purposes.
That's where the Creeper Act comes in, right? Now, if for those listeners who are not familiar with the Creeper Act, it was a bill that was passed through Congress, I believe last year, June of last year. Basically, what this Creeper Act seeks to do is...
It was done in 2017.
Right. It was introduced in 2017. It passed Congress. the House, I should say, last year, and it hasn't become a law yet. It has to go through the Senate still. But basically what the CREPR Act seeks to do is to prevent the distribution or importing of child sex dolls in the United States. And so these are, you know, dolls that are anatomically accurate. So it simulates a real little children that can be used for sexual purposes. Now, the CREPR Act, I believe the full name is Curbing Realistic Exploitative Electronic Pedophilic Robots Act. And so that's what the bill is about. And so think of it this way, right? Here is an image of a child. Now, what's wrong with using it for sexual purposes? I would say that, again, based on my conversation with Rob Ray on video gaming and things like that, I am using my will to enact a criminal situation, morally wrong and morally evil situation. Even though this is just an image, it's not just an image, right? Just as if I were to take my wedding ring and chuck it across the room, it's not just a neutral act, is it? Like, I'm saying all kinds of things about my marriage. And my wife certainly would not be happy with me doing that.
One of the things that I think is important to understand here is that I would argue that this machine or doll that's made to look like a child for sexual purposes, I would argue that that machine or doll does not have value, that that machine or doll does not have dignity. It's a machine. And I think that this is one of the aspects that the court misses with regards to even virtual images that look like human beings, is what constantly is being questioned ethically is, are any persons being harmed through the use of this machine? And so they would say, okay, well, you got a child that you got a machine that looks like a child, but no child's being hurt through this user using that machine. Where the law, I think, is neglecting to see the harm is not the harm that is done to that machine, but the harm that's done to the person that's using the machine, and then the potential harm that that person using the machine could cause on society. And one illustration of this is that it's already been demonstrated in research back all the way even in 2006 that child pornography offending is a valid diagnostic indicator of pedophilia. So we already know that using virtual images or images in general of children for sexual purposes, that leads to pedophilia, that it leads to them acting on real people. And so when you've got machines, dolls that look incredibly lifelike, then it shouldn't surprise you that those using those machines would be more likely to offend on a real human being. See, you've dehumanized that person, and that person's understanding of human beings is being dehumanized. So you've got A, the harm done to that person, and the potential harm for society at large. Terry, what's the case that's going on here in Canada?
There's a guy in St. John's, New Brunswick. He has two charges of smuggling and possession of prohibited goods. And this is reference to a sex doll depicted as a child. So this has been in the courts for about 5 years or more. Oh, and wow. It actually just came up in the news yesterday as well, as he collapsed in court and they had to take him out, that kind of thing. But it's right here in our country as well.
Well, and a lot of people may not even realize that in Vancouver, I believe it was last year, a brothel was opened up and is in operation with adult sex dolls. So this is definitely something that is growing. It's not going away. And one of the aspects of this that we haven't even touched on yet is what happens, and this is already taking place virtually, where virtual images of real people can be created. So famous people, or what about even your neighbor? You know, you send in a picture of your neighbor and you're like, you know, send me back some, you know, virtual pornography of so-and-so. Again, a question that needs to be raised is, well, what happens when you can start doing this with machines?
In machines that depict little children, right? But not just children in the generic sense.
Right.
You know, if somebody made an image of my daughter and started doing terrible things to it, I wouldn't take that to be just a neutral act. Now, somehow this is not just a generic thing anymore. It's person specific. And the fact that this person is willfully acting out this thing now is a great offense to the dignity, I would argue, to my child.
Yeah. And in that case, I am with you, Steve. I think in that case that the dignity of your child is specifically being imaged in that machine. And legally, that is, from what I understand with regards to the law, that would be illegal because it's imaging a specific child. And so it's causing harm to that child. However, I just think how slippery that slope is. I mean, if you're creating a machine that looks like a human being, I mean, surely it could look like some kid, but I guess it's the intention. One thing I think is important here, though, with regards to an ontology of purpose, notice how this is being played out ethically with regards to the importation of these devices. If this was just a doll for your child to play with, that's a life-size doll, you're not going to be seeing any jail time. However, this is a doll specifically with the purpose of having sex with, thus it's obscene. And so I think that this is an important philosophical idea to see could help us, and we're going to need more of these sorts of things to help us navigate the technological future. These ethical dilemmas are not going to go away. They're going to continue, and we're going to need different tools to be able to see them and be able to identify them easily. If I could just give out one shout out before we close this episode, I think this goes back again to more Christians needing to be involved in the ethics of our society. I was really convicted of this when I hear, you know, this homicide detective saying, we really need people to do something about this. And I think he's right. I think we need to, and I know that there's philosophers or different politicians that listen to the show. I think that, you know, and leaders that listen to the show, we've got to be more proactive in saying, hey, you know, Canada, hey, United States, hey, Australia, hey, New Zealand, wherever you're listening from, you know, this isn't good. So what do we need to do to be ahead of this instead of constantly playing catch up and to say this needs to be outlawed? This cannot be acceptable in our culture.
Any last thoughts, Steve?
Nope. Well, Andy's just singing my song, so. Yeah.
All right. Well, there's lots to talk about here, and we might revisit this again for sure in coming podcasts, but for now, we'll have to leave it there. So we really appreciate you listeners for joining us again this week. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.